It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday as the COVID-19 pandemic is changing our lives dramatically and so quickly. This hour, we want to offer you a number of informed perspectives from here in Iowa on this quickly emerging public health emergency. This afternoon at about 4:30, our governor, Kim Reynolds, will be speaking. Before that, President Trump will be declaring a national emergency, according to a senior administration official, invoking what is called the Stafford Act that allows FEMA to coordinate disaster response and aid to state and local governments. This hour, we're going to hear from a number of informed perspectives. We'd like to hear from you as well with your questions, your concerns. Only via email, please. No calls today. Via email, your questions, your concerns. Perhaps you have an observation or an anecdote to relay concerning the new coronavirus pandemic. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's begin our conversation this hour with Edith Parker. She is Dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health, also a professor of community and behavioral health in that college at the University of Iowa. Dean Parker, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's good to be here.
We are all a bit shocked taking it in. I want to know for you, Dean Parker, in your position, what is top of mind?
Thanks, Ben. I think what is top of mind is really to get the message out to everyone that this is a very serious illness and that we really need to take the precautions that are being recommended by the public health community. I know that for some folks, they're looking at as information comes out on this and they're thinking, well, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm not in that demographic risk category. And I think my message to them is, you may not be, although it's evolving in terms of who may be greatest at risk, but even if you are not in that risk category, we ask that you really practice the non-pharmaceutical interventions that the public health community is suggesting, things such as social distancing, trying to stay 6 feet apart, washing your hands with soap and water, avoiding large gatherings. If you're sick or have symptoms, staying at home, because all of these are really the non-pharmaceutical interventions that might help us to slow down the spread of the disease. I think that many people have seen the kind of epidemiological curve, the information out there about how if we start doing these protective measures, we may be able to flatten that curve, which will slow down the transmission of the cases. And that's going to be important both because it gives us time, perhaps, for the eventual development of a vaccine, but also because it will help us in terms of making sure that the healthcare system has a capacity because there will be fewer cases and fewer transmission of
right.
the disease.
Right. So what I hear you saying, Dean Parker, is if we can spread out the time that we don't all get this at once or within a short number of weeks, we will have the number, hopefully, the number of hospital beds, the respirators that are needed for the real critical cases. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that would help us to be a much better place to avoid what we're seeing in other countries, such as Italy, where the healthcare system is just overwhelmed now.
Mm-hmm. Juxtapose Italy with South Korea and even China, though, you know, in China's case, we're not sure about the information coming out of China. But South Korea, I think we can rely on. They've had some, I guess you could say, draconian measures, but it seems to be very effective. Right? Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I feel like it has gotten our attention. Yesterday, there were a lot of decisions made around sporting events. And let me be the first to say, I am a big basketball fan, so I'm not sure what I'll do with my time this week. But as a public health professional, I thought it was absolutely the right thing to do to sort of cancel these mass, you know, attended events, particularly in this case with people coming from all over the country. So you don't know what they've been exposed to or, you know, what's going on in the communities where they come from.
Right. Louisiana postponing its April 4th primary. So many things, cancellations, postponements that we could list here. I'm seeing in the New York Times at least six states closing all schools. That number will no doubt go up. Spain declaring a state of emergency, ordering its first mandatory lockdowns. And again, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, the president will be speaking this afternoon and will be declaring a national emergency. You mentioned flattening the curve. We hear that phrase here, Dean Parker, in this context. What does that mean as a in epidemiological terms? Because we have to sort of all of us now understand how viruses and diseases move in a large or can move in a large population, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think there's, we're actually talked to some students today who are trying to tweet this because they think it's a very effective message, particularly for their age group to understand this. But essentially, with a pandemic, then you've got to remember that, particularly with pandemics, unlike, say, influenza B that we have, you know, each year, so there's vaccines, there might be some immunity that we have. This is something we've never seen before. So this, you know, this pandemic is going to really spike if we do no protective measures, so that you would see a large number of cases. Whereas if you can begin to do some of this social isolation and reduce the transmission, then you may still have the same cases, but they're going to be spread out in a much gentler curve. So the curve won't have as high of a spike. And that may give us, as you said, really the time and also not impact the healthcare system in terms of, say, employees there getting sick, et cetera, but also just the equipment and the capacities of those healthcare systems. So really you want to, quote, flatten that curve, spread it out more, and that would hopefully allow time, you know, for this so that our systems would not be as overwhelmed.
Dean Edith Parker, please stay with us, Dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. We invite you to join our conversation this hour with your questions, your concern, as we all absorb the shock of it's a new era for us. We don't know how long it will last. It is certainly changing our everyday lives, or should be, in very dramatic ways so that we can stem the spread of COVID-19. Email your questions, your concerns, your observations to us this hour, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. This hour, only no phones, only via email, please, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me and Dean Parker is Mike Pantella. Mike is a clinical professor of epidemiology at the University of Iowa. He's also director of the State Hygienic Public Health Laboratory in Coralville. Mike Pantella, Professor Pantella, welcome to us. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. It's been a busy time there, I know, for you at the State Public Health Laboratory in Coralville. Fill us in on the role that lab plays in what we're seeing play out now.
Well, whenever you're looking at a pandemic or any outbreak of disease, testing capacity to quickly identify cases is most important. In public health laboratories like the State Hygienic Lab in Coralville is that resource for the citizens of Iowa for that testing capacity to quickly identify those cases. Once a case is identified, then that patient can be isolated so they don't infect others that they come in contact with. And then public health action can be taken by determining who the contacts are of that infected patient and tracing back to those contacts. And in the case of someone infected with COVID-19, it may be necessary to quarantine that contact because of risk of transmitting it to others in the community. Mm-hmm. And that's what has been used in other parts of the world. So whenever you get that information of the detection of cases through that testing, then public health can go into gear and stop transmission.
What is the state, Mike Pantella, of our testing? The news that I've been taking in is that our testing is sorely lacking in the country. Can you give us your comment?
Well, from an Iowa's perspective, we feel that we have the testing capacity at this time that we need. Certainly moving forward, we have to consider what the demands will be and the potential to ramp up that testing capacity. Mm-hmm. We know that the state public health laboratories throughout the nation are performing testing, as well as some commercial laboratories who are also performing testing. So I can only speak for Iowa that we feel we have the capacity at this time to meet the needs that are needed.
Mm-hmm. Phil has a question along these lines, perhaps for you, Mike Pentella. He asks, where in the state of Iowa is testing for coronavirus available, and what is the procedure generally if one wants or needs to get tested? That question from our listener, Phil.
Sure. The testing is available from the State Public Health Laboratory here in Coralville. And it's also available, as I mentioned, from the commercial laboratories. At this time, the Iowa Department of Public Health sets criteria for those patients to meet who should be tested at the State Hygienic Laboratory. And they released that criteria yesterday. What happens is if a person has signs and symptoms and have reason to suspect that they have COVID-19 and visits their physician, they should do so by contacting their physician and letting them know why they suspect they might have it, because their physician may want to take precautions so they don't expose individuals in, say, a waiting room, for example.
Right.
But they would then see their physician, who would determine if a test is necessary, if they meet the criteria, and then take a nasal pharyngeal swab. Now, the CDC just changed this yesterday. We were testing before this a nasal pharyngeal swab and a oral or throat swab, but they changed it to just nasal pharyngeal yesterday. Then that swab is placed in transport media and it's shipped to the state hygienic laboratory. We are testing at this time all the specimens that we receive by 8 o'clock in the morning so that we can get results out that afternoon. So it also is important to us to maximize our capacity by performing the testing in batch form.
Right. Can you tell us as of today and perhaps you're, I don't know, what you can tell us about the data you have in terms of the tests that you've made and the number of positives? Is that something that you can tell us about at this time?
That data is at the Iowa Department of Public Health's webpage. They have a page devoted to coronavirus. It's under IDPH Emerging Health Issues Novel Coronavirus. And so far, there have been 128 tests and 16 positives.
Okay.
That will change, of course.
Right. Right. Day. This is changing very quickly. It is growing exponentially. When you think about the challenge we face, Mike Pentella, there as a epidemiologist, what are your biggest concerns or questions going forward that you have, and how will we know how hard and how quickly we will be hit by this epidemic?
Well, as you were speaking with Dean Parker in talking about flattening that curve, the typical bell-shaped curve, it's a steep curve for an epidemic like this. But if you can flatten that curve so it's not as steep, then you know that your actions that you're taking are being effective. So the number of test requests we get and the percent of those that are positive being monitored tells you if your intervention actions are being effective or not. So we would like this to have a gradual rise in the number of cases instead of an exponential rise in the number of cases.
And that is, as we've been emphasizing, that depends on how each of us as individuals behave right now, correct?
Absolutely. The washing your hands for at least 20 seconds, avoiding close contact with those who are sick. Avoid touching our eyes, our nose, our mouth. And that's can be difficult because you don't realize how often you do that. If you do feel sick or feel like you're getting sick, stay home. Cover your coughs and sneezes. And clean those frequently touched surfaces with disinfectants.
Okay. On that point, William from Grimes is listening. He had a couple of different points, but one to what you were just saying. He wants to know, for instance, how long will the virus survive on dollar bills, on surfaces?
We don't know the answer to that that I've seen at this time. I'm sure they will study that. But the different types of surfaces, like it's metal, countertops, et cetera, have to be studied to determine how long the virus can survive. In money, exactly, we know that bacteria and viruses can survive on money. But the important thing is when you touch those items to wash your hands or use one of those hand disinfectant products with 60 to 70% alcohol and avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth before you've cleaned your hands. That's the important action to take. Mm-hmm. So all of us should monitor how often during a day do we wash our hands and up that frequency.
Mike Bentella, director of the State Hygienic Public Health Laboratory in Coralville. Also with us, Dean Edith Parker of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. We have about 5 minutes before we'll say goodbye to the two of you, but we have so many email questions. Let me ask this, and I don't know if Dean Parker or if you, Mike Pentella, can, we'll just see to the extent you can respond to this. Christian in Shoeyville asks, can your guest comment estimate the potential best worst-case number of Iowans that could possibly need hospitalization for COVID-19, then compare that to the number of available staff, operational hospital beds available statewide in Iowa for those patients. Now, Dean Parker, I know we don't have, I'm guessing you don't either, have those statistics right at your hand, but that's a huge central question, isn't it?
Yes, no, I really don't, and I don't think I can speculate at this time. I don't know, Mike, if you feel like you have any thoughts about that.
No, I'm sorry, I don't have those kinds of figures and haven't calculated that out. But I'm sure that others in the state are doing that.
All right. Mike, you mentioned something there a few minutes ago about waiting rooms. I was at an urgent care facility yesterday for a different reason, a little bit of a shoulder problem, nothing to do with a respiratory virus. But on the door going into this urgent care facility in Coralville, there was a big sign. If you have a cough or any flu-like symptoms, do not come into the waiting room. They asked you to turn around to contact them, I think either via phone or via the internet, to make an appointment. Mike, and this is all toward the point that you made, that you don't put yourself in a situation where you can infect other people, even if you need help, if it's a waiting room, right?
That's right, because when you come in contact with other individuals who may have a respiratory infection, you're becoming at risk yourself. So that individual who may have a respiratory infection, following that guidance on that sign will really help the prevention efforts. So I know it's inconvenient for people, but this is the time for us to take those kinds of actions to keep our friends and neighbors and community safe.
Okay.
So, Ben?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry. This is Edith. I did want to just, because I think you hinted at something and Mike talked about it too, to the question about, what is the projections of the hospitalizations, potential deaths, and do we have enough beds? I do want to reassure the public that, our IDPH, our local hospitals, our state officials have done extensive preparedness planning. So I think this is not something that started just when this emerged, but has been, plans in place for these types of pandemics. So I think it's important for people to know that we are, spent a lot of time in preparedness in this state with our agencies, our hospitals, our university here, and that we're going to begin to see the fruit of those preparedness actions as we move forward.
Let me offer one more email, at least from our listeners, before our conversation needs to end in about 3 or 4 minutes. Barb from Johnston, this is her email. I have had flu-like illness for 5 days. Yesterday I went and was tested for flu, which came back negative. However, I was deemed not sick enough to be tested for COVID-19. How will we know, asks Barb, the incidence of this disease if there aren't tests on mild cases? Mike Pentella.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very good question that Barb asks. And we will know the best we can, and there might be further studies later on to do antibody testing to determine individuals who had the infection but were not detected. Because we know that most people who get COVID-19 will get very mild disease. Many people won't even need to see a physician. And those people, though, their immune system will produce antibodies against the virus, and studies will be done later to make estimates of what the exact incidence of the disease was. But at this time, if somebody didn't meet the criteria for testing, and it could be several other viruses that are also circulating in our community. Barb said that she tested negative for influenza, but it could have been a parainfluenza or another coronavirus or a human metapneumovirus. All these viruses and more are circulating in our communities at this time.
Mm-hmm. And when we, Mike Pentella, as an epidemiologist, I didn't look today, but yesterday we went, this week we've gone over 1,000 confirmed cases in our country. I expect that's quite a bit higher today, perhaps 2,000. I don't have the latest figures. Is your suspicion that there are, what is your suspicion as to the number of people with the virus that have just not been confirmed, that 1,000 or 2,000 figure is what percentage of the number of people would you, can you even speculate about how many people of our population here in the U.S. have it already?
You really can't speculate, Ben. It's impossible to know. We have to do a lot more studies to determine what the attack rate is, to determine how many people who are exposed will acquire the virus. So right now, the CDC says there are a total of 1,600 cases in the country. We know that there is in other parts of the country, but not in Iowa yet, community transmission.
Okay.
And
we have to go. We're coming up on a break. Mike Pentella and Edith Parker, you've been generous with your time. Thank you so much for your expertise. Mike Pentella, director of the State Hygienic Public Health Laboratory in Coralville, and epidemiologist. Also, Edith Parker, dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll get a view from a medical anthropologist, Emily Wenzel. Also, a political view from James Lynch, political reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about how the COVID-19 pandemic is changing our lives quickly and so dramatically, getting different perspectives, informed perspectives from here in Iowa. In the last half hour, if you were not with us, we had the director of the State Hygienic Public Health Laboratory in Coralville. Also, he's an epidemiologist, also the dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. This half hour, we're going to shift gears slightly to get two different perspectives. Later in the hour, we'll talk politics and what's happening at the State House concerning corona, or is not, with James Lynch, political reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Earlier this week, we thought this was going to be a Pints and Politics hour. We thought we were going to have a Pints and Politics evening last night in Cedar Rapids. Of course, a gathering of several hundred people is not in tune with our times, and that's why this show was changed quickly to what we have today to respond to the news of the day. Let's talk with Emily Wenzel, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Director of the International Program at the University of Iowa. She is a medical anthropologist. Emily Wenzel, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your expertise and how you are measuring, evaluating this epidemic, now pandemic?
So as you said, I'm a medical anthropologist. Anthropology is the study of what people do and have done, and I study how cultural differences shape our different ideas about sickness, health, healing, and the way we use medical intervention. So I've sort of been leading up to this my whole career, basically.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, this is the thing medical anthropologists are trained to analyze. So one thing we look at is how different cultures on local or national level combine with different structures, like economic structures, healthcare structures, to shape our response to emerging diseases. So this is a really clear example of that. And you can see how different countries have responded quite differently to this pandemic with having different effects.
Compare the cultures. We mentioned Italy early in the hour. I think they're on one end of the spectrum. That is where the pandemic, the disease has been rapidly spreading. Juxtapose that with maybe South Korea, where their stringent, aggressive actions have stemmed it. Is that the sort of cultural differences you are comparing, Emily?
Yeah, absolutely. So one way in which cultures vary a lot is emphasis on the collective good versus the individual good. So, for example, in South Korea, you'll see more emphasis on protecting the collective good. Ideas about how self-quarantine, for example, is important to help others. In other cultures, there are more ideas about individual freedom. I would say also the U.S. is really on that spectrum. So thinking about the individual first, the collective second. So all that's going to shape how individuals react when they think they might have been exposed to a virus, and also how health systems are funded and structured. Another cultural difference revolves around local history. So, for example, there have been things like SARS that have affected Asian countries and that the U.S. kind of, and Italy also, escaped from. So that history changes a cultural response to then the next epidemic.
Mm-hmm. What other questions are out there for you as a medical anthropologist as we experience this in real time, our culture, our Iowa culture, our national culture, our world culture moving through this pandemic?
Well, here we see really how the ethical choices we make in a stressed moment like this reflect these broader cultural and structural histories. So, for example, in the U.S., we have a real culture of individualism. And we excel at what philosophers call the freedom too, right? We have very strong civil liberties that have been a model. We have very strong rights. We often try to deregulate things and have less regulation. So people are allowed to do a lot of the stuff they want to do. What we don't emphasize is what philosophers call freedom from, right? Things that protect a society on that collective rather than the individual level. So social safety nets. Things like universal health care, and also the idea of putting others before oneself or thinking of the collective in one's decision-making are just not the primary elements of our culture. Mm-hmm. So what all that then leads to are things like we just heard about in the news break, right? Things like people sort of taking a box of masks instead of one mask, or influences people's decision-making about whether to social distance or self-isolate, how the culture shapes our social support systems and healthcare systems and economic systems also matters a lot. For example, there was just a bill defeated to provide paid sick leave. So we have a system where people who are sick often need to go to work or they're going to lose their jobs, right? If you work in food service, if you work in the hotel industry, any number of careers like that, you get paid for showing up. And if you don't show up, you can lose your job. So we don't have a system that provides support in those cases. And that then becomes a problem when we really want people to stop showing up to places sick, but people might be facing problems of unemployment or homelessness or starvation that are just as pressing as a virus.
Right. Here's an email, Emily, that will tap into not our need for money, but sort of spiritual sustenance. And perhaps you can comment on this. Terry writes, I am part of a small church of about 70 people. Nearly everyone is between 75 and 85 years old. I am 79. Should we be having church service? Should I go if they are held? Now, my medical expertise certainly doesn't go there. Emily, I don't know the degree to which you can answer that or comment on from as an anthropologist.
Yeah, well, I think that also gets to the cultural question we're talking about of if people have sort of become accustomed to worshiping in a certain way, and that's really spiritually important. What do you do when that then becomes dangerous from a public health standpoint? So I am not a physician, but I would say please do not go to that service. Everyone should really stay home if possible at this point. But that means we're going to see really some immediate cultural changes needed, in this case, in the culture of worship. How can you come together as a group while you're spatially separated and practice your faith in a way that provides some guidance and clarity and spiritual sustenance at this difficult time while also not putting each other in danger? And I think luckily we have some technologies like the phone, internet, that can facilitate that. But I think we're going to see a lot of cultural innovation around those questions, and I hope that we do.
Right. And Terry, maybe I can add to this your question about attending a religious service. Yesterday, we were interested in that question, how religious communities were coping, adapting to this. I spoke on this program yesterday with a rabbi in Des Moines area at a temple in Des Moines, and he was saying they are scrambling, trying to accommodate people who want to worship, also trying to build up online worship participation there. So you might want to see if you can give a ring to your church, whatever religious community you belong to, inform yourself over the internet or perhaps with a good old telephone call to find out how they are adapting, because every one of us needs to adapt. I don't know, Emily, if we can point to really anyone who is left out of massive changes to their life and a lot to our working careers, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a sort of transformative event. I've certainly never lived through anything like this. It's not the world's first pandemic, and it's interesting to look back historically and see sort of, to some extent, how quickly we tend to forget on a global scale. So that's also a cultural innovation I would like to see, is that maybe this time we can not only remember, but really try to make structural changes that can mitigate the outcome of this. I think from an anthropological perspective, we don't want to call anything natural, right? We always talk about how what we call natural disaster, how it plays out is profoundly shaped by what humans have done, right? A hurricane doesn't matter if you didn't build on the beach, for example. So this is a case where, yeah, there's a virus that's out in the world. We don't control that. But things like how we can respond, but again, how vulnerable people are already, what kinds of safety nets we have in place, how well-funded and structured our healthcare systems are, those are things that we can control and we can change in the future.
Emily Wenzel is a medical anthropologist on the faculty at the University of Iowa. Emily, stay with us. We want to add to our conversation as we come up to the last quarter of this hour. James Lynch, political reporter for the Gazette, joins us. Hi, James.
Hi, Ben.
What a difference a day or two can make.
But,
we were planning Pints and Politics for last night in Cedar Rapids before an audience of several hundred people. We have such a good time. One of the many, many cancellations out there across the state and across the country. We wanted to get in touch with you, James, to have you tell us what you know about what's been happening at the State House, also with the governor. What are you tracking there?
Well, it's been pretty much business as usual this week at the Capitol. Yesterday, there were school groups coming through. It's that time of the year when they make their field trips to the Capitol, and there were hundreds of elementary school kids at the Capitol. There were older high school students there for, I forget the name of it, Safe Schools, Iowa Safe Schools. They were there to meet with legislators as well. And, so it's pretty much business as usual. The leaders keep telling us that they're in daily or more frequent contact with public health officials than the governor's office. And if there's evidence of community spread, they'll reassess the situation. And I'm not sure what steps they can take at that point, unless they suspend the legislature for a period of time. But for the time being, it's business as usual. And I would say that with the caveat that could all change even as we're talking.
Right.
Over the weekend, things could change and there'll be a new sort of business as usual come Monday.
I'm seeing that we're to hear from Governor Kim Reynolds later today, I think 4:30. Do you know anything about what she may address or any particulars?
I don't, Ben. At this point, I don't know. But, you know, it's probably not good news, I'm guessing. And, you know, it's probably more cases or taking more steps. There have been a lot of speculation that there are plans being made to shut down state office buildings and have people work from home or work remotely. And this, you know, we've seen it with the universities, the steps they've taken, and this may become more widespread across all of state government.
Right. And I think I've seen, was it six states shutting down public schools? We're not at that point here, but we've been keeping a track of the institutions of higher learning, the universities, public and private, and colleges here making accommodations there as well. James Lynch, one of our listeners, William, asked via email about the impact of the virus on the November election. But, of course, we're in a primary season, so we've already seen that today's news brings us the fact that Louisiana will postpone its April 4th primary. That's the first state to do so. What are your thoughts as we have this land right in the middle of the primary season? It's going to be a huge shaping factor.
It could very well. I mean, if people avoid going to the polls. I was talking to Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate Thursday, and he said election day will be election day. He said, you know, we plan for tornadoes, we plan for fires, we make all sorts of contingency plans. This is part of that planning process. One part of the plan would be to encourage people to vote by mail, do the early balloting, the absentee balloting, and vote by mail. But it may make it harder to find poll workers, you know, who many of them are older people, retired people, who may not want to go to a public space like a polling station. But they're aware of the situation, as we all are, and they're already making plans. I think it's quite likely that there's going to be a tremendous effort to get people to vote by mail rather than showing up in person. But Secretary Pate said that Election Day will be Election Day.
Mm-hmm. Back to what I mentioned a moment ago about the other states' schools closing. You need to check with your school district, of course, if there's any closings or changes.
Mm-hmm.
To add to what I said, the Des Moines Public School District has announced that it is canceling all classes
right. And
programs for at least the next 17 days, beginning Friday at 6 p.m. And so you'll want to get in touch with your local school district. They say their goal is to resume school on Monday, March 30th. But of course, this is moving so quickly, changing so quickly, as we can see in many different aspects, that you need to really keep up to date on if the event, if your daily work, your daily school is happening as it has in the past, very likely that it will have been changed or somehow otherwise accommodated. James Lynch, perhaps too early to speculate on this, but we've seen reactions. I mean, we don't have to go back too far in history to see a natural disaster of a different sort, Katrina, the hurricane, when George W. Bush was in office, and that is one of the things forever linked to his name. The degree to which our leaders at a state or federal level react well to disasters is a big part of how we will judge them, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And you're absolutely right, Ben. This is something that people will use to judge President Trump as well as Governor Reynolds' reaction. And I think she's trying to be very proactive, having near daily press conferences and updates. And, you know, but yes, people will judge her administration as governor on her response to coronavirus. And, it's really uncharted territories for most people in those sorts of offices.
Emily Wenzel, you're standing by there, part of our conversation as a medical anthropologist. We have about 5 minutes left. What other aspects here should we talk about here?
Well, I really think what you're getting into with talking about Katrina and natural disasters is important, because we can think of ways we've learned from other, perhaps dissimilar disasters in this case. What were ways people have come together, not spatially, but in terms of solidarity to make change, what have been successes and failures. So I think it's helpful to cast a wide net thinking creatively there. I also really do want to underline that disaster is not natural, right? So speaking comparatively, as is my job as an anthropologist to look at multiple cultures, different countries are having quite different case fatality rates. And so we see the same virus, but we see different populations, but also different levels of healthcare support, different levels of testing, and different levels of preparedness, also different levels of existing poverty and social inequality. So I think it's important to remember that there's not really an inherent fatality of a particular virus. There's the virus meeting the social world we've created. And we need to be mindful that we're ongoing, we're still creating that social world every moment. So every choice an individual makes, to isolate or not, shapes that social world. Every choice our political leaders make to give guidance, to sort of not give that guidance, to create more support, that changes things moment by moment. So I guess that's in some ways a hopeful message that we sort of have the culture we have the system we have, and we have the virus we now have. But we also, every moment, have the power to make new choices, to have cultural innovation, and to respond. And so I would just hope people would be thinking about that in a hopeful sense.
Mm-hmm. Also, Emily, I wonder if you look at this, because, of course, here in Iowa, as in any state, we have rural and urban cultures here. I've been seeing on NPR how the rural towns may be insulated from the coronavirus now, but take a harder hit later because of the density of the population there being more spread out. But also, do you look at the difference between city and country culture?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're really right to point out that there's the sort of social differences in how people behave, but also the spatial differences, the economic differences. Those are definitely going to matter. We've seen, I think, just by chance, things started in some Western urban cities in the U.S. But they are going to play out very differently in rural areas. I honestly don't know how. And again, I think that's because it's going to depend so much on behavior, whether or not people sort of heed warnings to isolate, and whether or not people are able to. Again, if you have to work at your job and otherwise you might be homeless, that's going to change your calculus.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right that things will be different, and I don't yet know how.
Right. And each of us have an individual story to tell about how our lives have already changed. But perhaps we can conclude here by having you each tell us maybe a personal anecdote or story or how your life is changing just in the last day or two and what you see in the future. James Lynch, as a political reporter for the Gazette, can you go about keeping track of what's going at the State House and other politics? How much is business as usual? How much will be really, you have to find a new way to step through this?
Well, I think there will be challenges. I mean, you're seeing small things. People, using hand sanitizer much more frequently. And I think people aware of sort of the safety precautions we sometimes forget. I went into a meeting yesterday at the Capitol. Four people shook my hand on the way in. Only one person, put their elbow out to avoid the handshake. There are some of those things. Going forward, I don't think we know how much this will affect us. I mean, if they shut down the Capitol, if they suspend the session, we're already seeing, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders canceling some of their campaign events, their large rallies. The Iowa Democratic Party is saying they're going to postpone mm-hmm. county conventions, which were scheduled for next weekend. It's interesting. Republicans are going ahead with their conventions tomorrow. So yeah. I don't think we know all the impacts that we'll face and all the changes we'll have to make.
Okay. Emily Wenzel, we have about 30 seconds for a final anecdote or observation from you.
Well, so I would observe that if we do this right, it'll seem like overkill because nothing bad will happen. And if we do it wrong, it'll be really wrong. So embrace the change, really listen to warnings, and do what you can do.
Okay. Emily Wenzel is a medical anthropologist on the faculty at the University of Iowa. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And James Lynch, political reporter for the Gazette, was planned to be on Pints and Politics. We joined us anyway when we rejigged the show to be what it is today. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Ben.
We'll keep you posted on all of the new developments with the coronavirus here on Iowa Public Radio, together with NPR and the BBC throughout the afternoon. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay well, wash your hands, and let's all do this together. Get through this epidemic together. Thanks for joining us.